Welcome to the first episode of the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast. Thank you for being here. It is really good to have you alongside us, and it is two Sams for the price of one. Sam Lana joins me, Sam Roberts, and we are really, really excited about what the next few weeks, months, years, epochs will bring us. We could be doing this forever, Sam. You know what you've signed up to here, don't you?
I am aware, yes. This could be our lives, as you say, for the next epoch. I'm not actually sure how long an epoch is. But,
no, it's long. Is it longer than an era? I'm not sure. There we go. Anyway, I have a lot of expectation. We have a huge amount of different guests and lots of people to speak to, lots of things to cover, lots of different ways to dissect the world of rugby. And I'm really, really looking forward to it. What are you most looking forward to, Sam? Or what have you been most looking forward to over the last few? Because it hasn't stopped the rugby season, has it?
I mean, it hasn't. It's great for us watchers. I'm not so sure how good it is for the players out there. When you see, I think it was 35 games Dupont played last season. That's not including the sevens, which we will come on to. But I think I've just been captivated by the Olympics. I mean, I know you're obviously a sports fan, not just a rugby fan, Sam, and it really is the greatest show on earth, and it has been wonderful the last 2 weeks. I think everything that Palace did was fantastic. I thought using the kind of the existing landmarks was wonderful, and we're going to touch on the Olympics a little bit later. We'll also then going to have a look at the rugby championships. We'll have a brief touch on that at the end of the show, and we're going to sandwich those two things with Twickenham chat. So we're going to talk about paying for Twickenham. Is there anything that rugby won't sell? Will you get a disagreement between Sam and I? We're averse to hot takes here, aren't we, Sam? So
we are. But let's not make them for making them sake. You know, I think we're both looking for the truth, the understanding, the understanding of the process, really. And you know, it's difficult. Rugby is in a very, very strange position at the moment. I'm sure we'll touch on upon that. But where rugby found itself, perhaps at its best, was in the Olympics, and perhaps that's best to start with. You know, into the Olympics we dive. I mean, every time it comes around, and I don't know whether it's my age, and I don't know because you get older, you value it more. But every time the Olympics comes around, I can't help but think just how special a 2 weeks and a bit it is. It's really, really wonderful for your sporting soul, isn't it?
It really is fantastic. I actually was wondering, Sam, not wishing to show your age here, but what is the first Olympics that you remember?
Okay, so 1988 was really, I mean, I was obviously, 1977 I was born, so I'm old. And I remember 1984. I don't remember before that. I remember the American Olympics of 1984, but not in any real detail. 1988... Because if you remember, 1988 exploded with steroid chat and Ben Johnson and Linford Christie and all that came around with it. And I remember being drawn in then, and then subsequently it has taken us in all sorts of different directions. And every single time, you don't think it's going to get any better. And I'm not alone in this sentiment that most of the sporting world thinks France did an incredible job putting on the Olympics, like we did in 2012, like every country has done. But every time it comes around, it just seems to go that little bit higher, even though you think that it can't. It's extraordinary.
It really is. I mean, for me, it was 2000, probably 2004.
Oh, you're so young.
I know, I do. But I met someone the other day who was born in 2006. And the first Olympics I remember was 2012, which was sickening. But
I meet those a lot, but they're called my sons.
Yes, so. Yeah. I can imagine it's more worrying for you than for me, Tom. I remember 2004, the time zone meant that I could basically watch anything. I'm not exactly sure how the TV worked then, but I imagine it was kind of just BBC One, BBC Two. I don't think we had a red button yet in 2004. Yeah.
No.
So really you were watching what they were willing to put on. And there was a sense of, I guess, being safe in the hands of the BBC, that they would show you whatever was the most enticing event. And I would happily watch absolutely anything that came on. To be honest, I'm the same now, Lily. I early on in the Olympics, I get quite excited by the option of, you know, really curating my own Olympics. And then by about the fourth or fifth day, I just fall back on whatever it is that they're willing to say and show me. What sports captured your imagination this time,
well,
Sam?
Well, likewise. And you know, I'm drawn, as many people are, to the human element of sport. I firmly believe the only reason we watch sport is because of the humans playing it. Yes, sport, you know, manifests itself in a variety of ways. We are all drawn to different sports, but ultimately we're drawn to the humans playing it. And the Olympics, and especially the coverage, and especially the BBC, does a particularly good job of drawing out the human elements, the mums and the dads, the relationships between coaches and player or participant, the journey, the way they've come through things. And the Olympics is the crowning moment for so many sports. And, you know, that's when it's really special. And we can argue, and probably can make an argument against the likes of football being a part of that. Maybe to a certain extent, things like basketball and things like that, who have such a big league and a big position in the world outside of the Olympics. But when you come into contact with, and you found yourself doing it, you found yourself watching, and within moments, within minutes of watching it, you were gripped by the process. And what is that it was on very late, what is that utterly ridiculous cycle race where there is about 600 cyclists on
the Midas thing?
Right, I did not know what was going on there, right?
Yeah.
But I watched it in absolute and entranced state, trying to work out whether or not I thought I would be able to throw another cyclist whilst cycling. I mean, I would definitely fall off, but their ability to sort of like slingshot each other around the corner. It was, again, you are looking at supreme athletes conducting supreme skill. And there was nothing that didn't captivate me. And I thought the British contingent did exceptionally well. But then I was also taken by the Irish and the way that they did what they did. And, you know, there were pockets of real stories and you know, obviously things that other stories that potentially have lit various different touch papers, you know, we're not going to go into that, but there were some genuinely wonderful stories about it. So I'm sorry to dodge the question, but everything captured my imagination 100%.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because I have the same feeling where I guess probably maybe like a lot of people, I will get absolutely captivated by something, or maybe two or three things. This time around, it was the diving and the skateboarding. Yeah. I was absolutely captivated by them. I thought diving has found the perfect format of that slowly building to a kind of crescendo. Every dive matters. You know, you don't really need to know what the scoring means to kind of understand it, because they do make it very clear on the screen what's actually happening. Yeah. And I was thinking, because obviously we're talking about rugby sevens ultimately here, because that's our bag. But I was thinking with diving, what would be my next step? If I wanted to continue watching diving, if I wanted to be more involved in that, what's my next step? And I had a look around, and very little, unfortunately. There's you know, there's going to be some events maybe televised, but is it going to be close enough to capture my imagination? And I wonder what your general feeling is with sevens. If we take off our rugby hats, because obviously we're predisposed, we know where to watch. Obviously, some of us are involved in actually being part of those broadcasts, so we kind of have a way in. But if we were to put ourselves in a position of someone who had no idea about sevens and got captivated by that opening weekend, what's the next step for them, Sam? And is that obvious enough?
Possibly need some work, but possibly we need to do that. I mean, I was going to suggest and say that perhaps one of the reasons why we found ourselves so engrossed in the sevens was because it was the Olympics, and the Olympics only happens once every 4 years and therefore brings with it something particularly special. The stadium was absolutely full because it only happens once every 4 years and because it's very special and everyone comes in. So that adds to the environment, to the feel of the place, to everything that's going on with that. And we, you and I know that rugby sevens is a great sport. Yeah. And it was a great sport in a cauldron, thus, you know, provided and created. It became an extraordinarily brilliant spectacle. It was on free-to-air TV, so everyone had access to it. I mean, but maybe our listeners don't know that the difference in free-to-air, you know, as terms of numbers, is like 10, 20 times the amount of people are going to see the Rugby Sevens because it's broadcast on BBC Sport main channels than if it was on Sky or TNT. 20 Absolutely. Times the amount of people. And when you put that into, let's imagine you're a shopkeeper and that you have, you do really well because you have 100 people who visit your shop each day. And you say, oh, I'm doing all right. It's okay. It's 100 people. I mean, I wish it was more. BBC Sport is 20 times that 100 people. It is 2,000 people coming to your shop every day.
Yeah.
And from that shopkeeper's point of view, the difference is ridiculous, is phenomenal. Yeah. And that's one of the bugbears that I have, is that the sport, we know it's a great sport. We know it's fantastic. It's on free-to-air TV. And no wonder everyone's talking about it.
Just to put some numbers on that, I mean, a really significant Champions Cup game on TNT Sport, we'd be looking at 250,000 people, maybe?
Yeah, maybe 300, 330, 340 sometimes on certain... Yeah. It's not much more than that.
Yeah, the kind of the most limp Sunday Six Nations fixture, maybe an Italy-France. I'm not saying that's, you know, it's got doesn't capture the imagination of kind of the average fan. About 3.5-4.5 million, probably.
And that's just massive. It's massive, Sam. Yeah. It's huge.
Yeah. And I think this is obviously what cricket has struggled with. Obviously, the 100 is on at the moment. And I must admit, I'm not a kind of a 100 hater. I know that's kind of quite a common thing to be. I truly don't really know enough about it. I haven't made the effort to watch any of it this time around. But that might be a disappointing way into the sport. However, it's a thing that has access to the mainstream because it's on BBC. It's also on Sky. But even the most exciting Ashes match, maybe it peaks at 1 million.
Yeah,
on Sky.
And when it would be so, when it would be 10, if not 11, 12 million on BBC.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just extraordinary. And to put it into rugby terms, you know, one of the big things that you and I say is about getting rugby on terrestrial TV in some shape or form. And rather obviously, at the moment, there is a platform at championship level to try and get rugby. And there are some great rugby games at championship level. If they were broadcast on BBC or even a highlights package on BBC, it would be transformative. For that particular level, and I don't know quite why or how we can get there, because there are certain things in the way. But I mean that again, that's a whole different thing. But it comes back to and your question around sevens is an amazing sport, and you and I have both been, or you hopefully have been to great sevens tournaments. They are. They're different. They're different to 15s. It's more of a party. You don't know when the next game is or who's in the next game. And it happens really quickly. But one thing's for sure, you get oodles of skill, oodles of tries, oodles of jeopardy, and it's fantastic. And you stick that in front of 75,000 people in a big stadium, call it the Olympics, no wonder it exploded. It's just no wonder it exploded. It's a great, great sport.
Can I end this segment with quite an unfair question, which I think we should come back to perhaps in later editions, and give you a brief amount of time to respond to this. But I look at sevens, I completely agree. I think it's a wonderful sport. I think that it's everything people tell us about modern sport and how you make it captivating. Sevens has. It's got the party atmosphere, it's got the massive characters, it's short, should appeal to the kind of the TikTok generation, although I again, we'll talk about that in later late years, how accurate that is. But it doesn't seem to be growing at the rate of knots that that would indicate. It, you know, that there isn't this kind of, you know, the Olympics will have boosted it. I think, you know, 2016 in Rio with Fiji winning, that will have boosted it. But it doesn't seem to have broken through in the way that you might imagine, given it is almost mm-hmm. exactly the mix that we are told sports need to have to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because it did the Olympics had some key factors. Antoine Dupont was a massive factor in that. France doing well was a massive factor in that, in a sense of carrying that through. Does that seven series, does 15s take away some of that spotlight? There was no other spotlight in the Olympics. There was no other rugby in the Olympics. Yeah. No other option. It wasn't as if the 15s was on a different day and we were all just watching sevens. It was the only version of rugby, and that's the tricky thing, because I think your question is about how that works and how we make that work or what's going wrong. Is to a certain extent they're kind of fighting against each other in some ways, and they're butting up against each other in trying to attract, you know, an audience. And if we were really, really tough and really, really wanted sevens would only happen for a window in the year where 15s was never played.
Yeah.
Yeah. That for me would be the logical process.
Yeah. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it? Is because if you got captivated by the sevens and you turned on the rugby championship on the weekend, that is a different sport. In exactly the same way as if you got captivated by the diving and you turned on freestyle skiing or ski jumping, you would not be seeing the same sport. And I do think that rugby's challenge, and we'll talk about this more in our Blindside episode, because we've got a great guest in Carly McKingan, who is based over in Seattle. She has got a really interesting backstory because she is a grassroots rugby player. She's played also a very high level. She's a communications manager for Rugby America's North currently as well. And she's been with the Seattle Seawolves. So she's going to hopefully tell us how America can captivate or take advantage of Ilona Meyer's huge popularity and boost them into this. Yeah, we've all heard of the sleeping giant kind of US rugby, but now we're going to find out how exactly they do that. But I do think sevens is a way in. But I don't necessarily see this being a clear transition between you get all the people who watch sevens at the Olympics and loved it, and you just pass them through and they become 15s fans in 12 months' time. I think that it's going to be a really, really difficult task, that. We're going to move on, though, Sam, and we're going to talk about something where there was no branding. The Stade de France had no branding on it because it's the Olympics, to something different. We're going to talk about Twickenham, or, as perhaps we should say, the Allianz Stadium. Give people the
whack me microphone then
in rage.
No, not in rage. No, I didn't do it in rage. I was laughing at you towing the corporate line. I like this about you, Sam. You're always there to try and make a buck. Do you think Allianz will enjoy that? Will they write to us and say, thank you for mentioning us as that? That's brilliant. Here's £10.
I hope they do, because I get a friend who had insurance with them and they never answered his call, so that I could pass them on to him if they did.
Yes, £100 million deal over 10 years, isn't it? To call it the Allianz Stadium.
It is. Yeah, so 10 million a year. I think my maths is correct on
you
that.
You are. I tell you what, you're lost. That's aren't you? I tell you.
So what is your initial impression, Sam? I've kept my cards close to my chest on this. I'm keen to hear what you have to say.
I think money into the game is always good. It's a professional sport, and we've got to understand that money is the thing that makes the sport work. Yes, I knew it would upset people. No, you don't have to call it the Allianz Stadium. Only people in certain roles in life have to call it the Allianz Stadium. You can still refer to it Twickenham. If anyone calls it Twickenham, or if you're ever told to go to Twickenham, it's still there. It's still the same stadium. It's still the same thing. But £100 million is a lot of money, and and it's a great deal that they've struck to do that. They are not the first stadium by any stretch of the imagination to do it, and they've done it. I was reminded. I read Sir Clive's point and his bit. I was reminded of a wonderful cartoon. Two frames of a cartoon. On one side, the man stood in front of a big crowd. He's saying, who wants change? And the whole crowd cheer, right? And then he says, who wants to change? And nobody cheers. and we have this at the moment. Everybody wants rugby to change and be better and be bigger and be more wonderful, but nobody actually wants it to change. When push comes to shove, everyone goes, I can't believe we're changing this. And so we're in this situation at the moment. And, you know, it will die away and it will be what it will be, like every other stadium naming, and it will be what it will be. The key thing, the absolutely key thing that I would like the people at the Allianz Stadium or Rugby HQ or Twickenham or wherever, whatever you want to call it, I'd like them to keep in contact with me and tell me what they're going to spend the £100 million on. Because if they're going to spend it just on Twickenham and improving the hospitality up there, I will be slightly disappointed. Rugby needs money. It needs to go into... I had a podcast last year with Stuart Lancaster who said, you need to get great coaches on the ground coaching grassroots rugby. You can't just rely on parents to do it all the time. You need great coaches. We need to put them back in place. We need to make sure that this sport has a longevity, and you can only do that by coaching young people really, really well. You need to support the game underneath the Premiership, underneath the England internationals. You need to get money into the game. If it doesn't go there, then I will be quite frustrated. Over to you, Sam Lana.
I disappointingly agree with you almost entirely, Sam. So I think I had a debate with someone about this on Twitter because they were making the case of what is the limit. It was very reasonable, but their point was kind of, you know, where would you draw the line of what you wouldn't sell? And I would say that the name of a stadium will come a long way before, say, a shirt sponsor. It's incredibly visible, a shirt sponsor. I think it was 1996 when England first had Cellnet on their jerseys. That is hugely more visible. If you're buying it, you're buying the branding as well. You know, you're getting the shirt with the name on. As you say, nobody is going to call it Twickenham. No. Some people are going to not call it Allianz Stadium because they don't know. Some people are going to call it that as a incredibly petty but quite amusing stance against corporate culture and against the naming rights. But ultimately, it's not going to make a jot of difference, really.
And let's face it, Allianz have only called it the Allianz Stadium so that there is a greater chance of somebody who might be looking for the sort of business that Allianz do, that they pick up the phone and speak to Allianz. It's all about getting their brand front and center. They don't, you know, Allianz don't want to upset anyone. They don't want to, you know, you guys not to call it Twickenham, but it's about getting that front and center. It's a purely, strategic marketing ploy. That's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah, where I perhaps I'm not going to say disagree, but I might have a slightly different take is I think it's quite common. We see stuff about, you know, the NHS, and it's quite common to say so much of this money goes to managers at the NHS, and it goes to admin, and it goes to secretaries and all this kind of stuff. I think fundamentally, if we compare the RFU and the NHS, they are enormous organisations which have a very basic and easy to understand task. NHS is keep us healthy. RFU, it's to grow rugby in the country and also be successful as an international team. So they have very fundamentally simple tasks, but delivering those tasks is unbelievably complicated. Mm-hmm. And you need someone who has got a good idea about where to put the money. You need someone who can hire well. You need someone who is in procurement, who can get a bunch of seats for Allianz Stadium at 50,000 rather than 80,000. You need all those kind of boring jobs which aren't immediately obvious that they provide value. Mm-hmm. And you need them often ahead of a cheaper, maybe grassroots coach. I mean, ultimately you need that grassroots coach, but you also need the higher ups to put them and point them in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you that I would be very disappointed if it goes into the hands of the already well off, you know, if it goes into hospitality, if it goes into making stuff cheaper that should already be as expensive, but ultimately it needs to go to grassroots. But I don't want to see it just immediately handed to the grassroots level. I want there to be some kind of organization in place that makes that long standing, because one of the issues we have in rugby is we take the money short term and then we spend it all and then we think, oh, we haven't actually made a difference here. And because there was no joined up thinking, we put $1 million there, put £500,000 there, we gave that person 10 grand, we put $2 million there, and it hasn't combined added up to much. So I think this is a massive opportunity, but I just think we need to be smart with that. And maybe that does mean employing some people on pretty decent wages, pulling them away from more lucrative jobs to come and do some of that work to be smarter.
The worry and the easy place for your mind to go is all of those coaches and all of that infrastructure and all of those things that were involved with those three academies that got ditched, you know, a few months ago. And, you know, there's a lot of heartache and these are young people, and these aren't young people all becoming rugby players. They are all young people all becoming human beings, and these academy structures were set up to make better human beings. And if you spend any time with any of these academy structures, you recognize that is the overriding thing that these academies are doing. Yes, they are producing rugby players, but they're not producing rugby players out of the 40 that might make it through at under 18, under 19 level, three of them will regularly play for the first team over the next 10 years. And they know that, and therefore they know that the most important thing is they are setting these kids up to have brilliant skills that are applicable to loads of different environments to which to go in. And three of those academies were ditched by the RFU, you know, less than 6 months ago. Maybe a bit more than 6 months ago. Apologies if the date is right, but relatively recently. And now they've got a £100 million deal over 10 years for the naming rights. And you're like, right, okay. It's just difficult. How can you look at those people who lost all their jobs and all those kids who have lost a place to play rugby and now have to travel for hours because Wasps has disappeared and Worcester has disappeared? That's a whole swathe of rugby belt that has just completely and utterly disappeared and been swallowed up in all sorts of different and crazy ways by the different other academies. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. It's really difficult. It's really difficult to make sense of it all. You've got to hope that someone at the top is leading this through and making it all make sense again to us all.
Yeah, and I completely agree. So it's you look at those academies, and I think this would stick in the claw. Because obviously the RFU knew that something like this was coming, probably a year out. These are long term discussions. Yeah, it's not,
don't happen by accident.
Yeah, Alliance don't discover $10 million down the back and think let's chuck that towards being England. So yeah, I think we should talk about this in a blindside episode about the financing of rugby, because it's incredibly complicated, but also it needs to be done right. Otherwise, you end up wasting what little money you have on frivolous things.
Yeah, 100%.
Shall we finish with a very brief look at the opening round of the Rugby Championship, Sam?
Yeah, we shall. Because, did it catch you out? It caught me out a little bit. I was like, hang on, what? We're going again with rugby?
It catches me out every single time. There was the Champions Cup, every round that song catches me out. I end up looking at on Wednesday and thinking, huh, Leicester are playing La Rochelle this week and not Queens. I'm always caught out by this kind of stuff. So yeah, and it was an interesting opening round. So Australia, who I think we were probably a little bit optimistic about, given their fairly comprehensive successes against Wales, were very well beaten by a South African side who who just look absolutely dominant. And
and keep on asking referees talent. Where scrums can be taken.
Yeah. And we might see more of that as this tournament progresses, given how absolutely dominant they were against Australia. And I think it's really an early warning shot for Joe Schmidt, because that is a concern that they were so out-muscled. But he will say, I suspect that he's at the start of a long building process, and his third game being against the world champions, even if it's at home, I think that comes a little bit early in the plan of action. Someone who might say something similar, though, would be Felipe Contepone, because Argentina beat New Zealand in New Zealand. Which they did a lot of stuff in this game. They scored more points against New Zealand ever, and New Zealand conceded the most points in a home test match since 2018 when they played South Africa. My question to you, Sam, really is, where is this Argentina side? Because I watched against France, I think, last month, and thought they're kind of a tier 1.5. They're kind of with Wales and with Scotland, maybe, where on their day they can beat anyone, but on their day they can lose to anyone as well. I don't know if this agrees with that or whether this is the start of something significant.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I don't think this wonderful result changes that too much. In a sense that this Argentina team has been for a while a group of extremely talented people who are working in a number of different pockets of the world and come together for certain matches every year and have to get a lot right early on. They strike me as a team that potentially don't spend as much time with each other as potentially other teams. I may be wrong. I'm sure there's someone out there who would tell me that they're wrong, but they just seem to me to be, and this result against New Zealand is exactly that. They have the potential 100%, and if everything aligns and it works and the opposition play ball and give them the opportunity in which to do it, they have some phenomenally exceptional players. I mean, Chocho Barres in the center is becoming a world-class player. And we know about the other areas of their game. They've always had incredible wing three courses. They've always had a very canny 9 and 10. They've always had a big pack and some horrible, notice they dropped H there, front rowers and second rowers and some brilliant exponents of the dark arts in the back row. I mean, in their parts, they have always been really, really dangerous. The sum of their parts has been the difficult bit with Argentina. Yeah. And I wonder whether or not they can build on this. But again, they at the end of this rugby championship, they will all split off and disappear off into the different parts of the world in which they play. And that's the difficulty, I think, in a sense. I don't know, but I don't think there are too many in that side that are playing a huge amount of rugby. And probably there are. I'll probably show my ignorance here, but the South American league and set up over there has not been realized, because of what happened with Super Rugby and the Aguilares and all of that. It hasn't done what it's done. Yeah. And so it's become disparate again. And once again, the talent they have has been pulled out to all the other different areas that it could possibly be employed in. So that's where I think they are. Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. There are more players in that squad who are unattached without contracts than there are playing in either Argentina or the US. So, I think this is something we should revisit in a future episode, because we need to get someone on from Argentina, I think, to dig into this, because similar to Georgia, similar to Fiji, I'd say as well, these are teams who punch, you would probably say, above their weight, but whilst Wales and England are very concerned about players moving abroad, those three teams have almost nobody playing in their own countries, and yet they're able to produce this very successful time after time wingers. And I guess the question that we will ask in a future episode is that a good idea? Is that a good plan? Or actually, would these teams be better growing their domestic leagues and maybe taking a short term hit but a longer term success? So that's something we should revisit, I think, Sam.
Yeah, we always spend far too long talking to each other, don't we? But there's so much to try and cram in. There is so much to try and cram in, and that's why I think this podcast over time will be a particularly good idea.
Yeah, and we've got a lot more to say. As you say, Sam, we've got a lot more to say, and this is an outlet. And we've loved doing this first episode. We've got plenty more to come. We've got a lot of very interesting guests. It's not just going to be me and you, Sam, which
no, I'm thank sure goodness.
I can hear the moans of disappointment coming from here. But we've got so much more to talk about, and we're going to have our Blindside episode later on this week as well. So subscribe. I don't know if you can like on the podcast platforms, but you get the gist.
Indeed. Look after yourselves. And until next time, this has been the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast.